Several novelists have taken up the story of Cain and Abel in the Old Testament and tried to give it a modern touch. One is Thornton Wilder's The Eighth Day, about two friends named Ashley and Lansing. One day the two are out target shooting when Lansing is mortally wounded. It appears to be an accident at first. But later Ashley is accused of murder. He's convicted and then sentenced. On the way to his execution, he's mysteriously rescued and set free. And the bulk of the center part of the book spends its time showing the rest of his life, a marked man, fleeing, fugitive, eventually making his way to South America, where he dies a lonely and premature death. Later in the book, the real murderer, a relative of the man who was killed, is revealed, and he escapes, fleeing to Russia. Well, Wilder does a considerable amount of rewriting here, and also rewrites the purpose of the story, or the message, out of the episode from the Old Testament, by in the eighth day saying that life is just unfair. The innocent are punished, and the wicked go free. Life is not fair to Ashley, who, like the ancient Abel, seems to end up as the hero. The real murderer is the bad guy, who, like Cain, spends the rest of his life in exile. One of the reviewers of Wilder's book said that the novel never comes off because it seems to lack variety. That is, nobody really wants to identify with Ashley, who gets the bad break. And certainly no one wants to identify with the real murderer who does the unthinkable. And at first glance, the Cain and Abel episode here in Genesis 4 has the same problem. Nobody wants to be dead Abel. Yet we certainly can't identify with the murderer Cain. Or can we? The story begins with Adam and Eve driving, with God driving Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden. The God who had bent over the man-shaped pile of dirt, who had put his lips against the mouth of the clay model and breathed into it the breath of life, the God who had carefully planted a lush garden as the man's home, the God who had noticed that this man was lonely, the God who had paraded a host of animals by this man searching for just the right one, the God who, while walking in the garden one evening, discovered the disobedient couple, the God who counseled them about their sin, the God who had carefully tailored lunar leather tunics for them to wear, this same God was no longer willing for the couple to have access to the tree of life, and so he chases them out, and he erects barriers to prevent their re-entry. But God doesn't desert these two, because in chapter 4, verse 1, the very next verse, we hear about their intimacy and the resulting pregnancy. And when the boy is born, his mother names him Cain, and she acknowledges that the child has come only with the help of the Lord. As Adam and Eve united to continue the human race, God was working in that union to create a third person, just as he had already made the first two. Soon the three are joined by another boy. This one's name is Abel. The four lived somewhere outside the Garden of Eden, not quite sure where. The ground apparently was fertile enough for Cain to raise his crops, and there was enough pasture land for the flocks of Abel. Adam apparently worked alongside the two boys in his business of clearing away the thorns and the thistles so he could plant his grain. Cain was a farmer like his dad. Abel was a shepherd. One day the two boys built an altar. Cain gathered up some of the produce on the farm, burned it up on a heap of stones as a sacrifice to God. Abel apparently was more particular about his sacrifice, and he offered on the altar his prize sheep from the flock. God liked what Abel brought, but he wasn't impressed with Cain's. Well, Cain immediately becomes depressed and angry. He begins to pout. God takes Cain aside and has a little chat with him about his hurt feelings and his negative reaction. And with the fire dying on the altars in the background, God says to Cain, "Why are you upset? It's written all over your face." And he told Cain that if you do the right things, your sacrifice and your life will be accepted, just like Abel's. But if you choose not to do the right things, then sin is like a wild animal. It's lurking outside the door of your house, waiting to consume you. And so Cain is told that if he gives in, sin will overtake him. If he resisted, he could master sin. Well, with that statement on God's part, the ball is clearly over here in Cain's court. And we wonder, will he play by the rules of God, or will he take another direction? Has Cain learned anything from the situation at the altar? Has he benefited from this little father-to-son chat with God himself? Will the older brother become a model citizen like little brother? And we begin to wonder, had mother and father told Cain about the business with the snake at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the unfortunate repercussions? And if he had been told, had he made the connection between the serpent and the tree and that sin-like animal waiting outside the door to his life? Well, Cain walked over to Abel, asked him to take a stroll out in the fields. We don't know what Abel thought, but I suspect he thought something like, big brother has no hard feelings. That little talk with God must have straightened him out. We only can wonder if Cain's angry eyes and downhearted face had disappeared. The field must have been some distance from the two altars that the brothers had erected. Cain at least thought that they were out of sight of God, because no sooner had they arrived in the field of wheat and barley than he found a good-sized stone caved in his brother's head. The ground turned red with Abel's blood, and Cain fled the scene. Well, Cain had killed a quarter of the world's population with one blow to his brother's head. Fortunately, his parents were not around, or during this time of anger, they would have been killed too, and we'd all been descended from a murderer rather than from his younger brother. Well, God eventually caught up with Cain, and he had some more questions for the older brother. The same God who had asked Adam where he was, the same God who had asked Adam if he'd eaten of the tree, the same God who asked Eve what she had done, and the same God who just moments before had asked Cain why he was angry and why his countenance was fallen, now asks, where is your brother, Abel? And Cain, who had offered that inferior sacrifice, Cain who was angry with God, Cain who went around with a gloomy face, Cain who deceived his brother by going out into the field, Cain who had killed Abel, the same Cain says, I don't know. And then, in effect, he says, I don't even care. He denied that he had any responsibility for his kid brother. And in a sense, Cain says, you created him, God. Why don't you look after little Abel? Well, it's here that we begin to understand that the fight in the story is not between brothers. The activity at the battle is not the big brother against the little brother. It's not sibling rivalry. But this is the story of human rebellion against God. Cain is fighting God. Oh, Abel gets in the way. Abel's easier to kill. Abel will go with him out to the field. But Cain is in a struggle with the Creator himself. Well, God had kindly taken the man aside, and he had tried to explain how he could do better, how he could live in harmony, how he could overcome these wicked forces of sin that were inside of him. Cain left that divine counseling session to premeditate murder. He made no attempt to cover his tracks, and then he lied to God himself. Then in a final act of defiance, Cain claimed no responsibility at all for his little brother. What we have here is outright rebellion. What we have here is insubordination. What we have here is a malcontent, an unsubmissive, ornery, disobedient man. We're not looking at the quiet garden couple who think before they act. We're not looking at the questioning Eve who eats only after she talks a while with the snake. But we see defiance. Cain doesn't need a snake in order to sin. He provides his own temptation. Cain doesn't need a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He can find sin among the rows of corn by turning human blood into fertilizer for the crop. Now, you might be thinking, bad Cain, wicked Cain. And if you give a little more thought to it, you might say, there are some people in Memphis that are as bad as Cain is. But there's nobody here like that. It's always more pleasant to think that we're more civilized than people in other places and other times. Apparently, that's what some people in the New Testament times were saying. And so John wrote to them, and he told them in 1 John chapter 3, don't you be like Cain, he said. He said, if you ignore the needs of your brother who's in need, or if your love is only speech and no action, or if your pantry is full and someone else is starving, and you don't help those people, then he says, don't you be like Cain. 1 John 3, 11 through 18. Yeah, we still want to say, but there's no one really here like this Cain. Apparently that's what some other people in New Testament times thought. And so Jude wrote to them in his little book toward the end of the New Testament. And he said, you walk in the way of Cain. He wasn't talking about people who commit murders down in the ghetto. He wasn't talking about people who rob out in the open highway. He was talking to Christians who twisted the Bible and who misused what God had said. He said, you're walking the way of Cain. Well, the New Testament writers are saying we may not look like Cain, but we're acting like him. Cain had anger written across his face. He let his rebelliousness lead him to murder. But it tends to play out differently in our lives. We don't often burst out in anger. but we let it smolder on the inside. We don't bear arms typically against our brother, but we sure do bear grudges. Rebellion against God doesn't mean that you murder your brother. It means you live in defiance of His will. It means you ignore what He says. It means you defy His commands. It means you revolt against His kingship. It means you disregard His leadership. It means you mutiny against the captain of the ship. Note that Cain's rebellion started in church. He was at the altar doing what he wanted to do. He brought what he wanted to bring. He offered what he wanted to offer. He wanted God's approval, but found out God was no pushover. And so God rejected Cain. And so Cain got up out of his pew and he stomped out mad because God wouldn't buy it. Why are you angry, Cain? And why is your face so downcast? Oh, I didn't get much out of that service, God. I want to do what I want to do, you know. And if I don't get my own way, I'm going to pout. And I'm going to be uncooperative and angry and bitter and rebellious. Keep your old altar, Lord. I've got to go see my kid brother. But God wouldn't stay out of Cain's way. And as the angry man came out of the field wiping the blood on his pants, God made further inquiry. Where's Abel? I don't know. Rebellion doesn't care. Rebellion sometimes so blinds us that maybe we don't know. Cain was so far down that road of revolt that he could lie to God, and God wouldn't even think that God wouldn't even know. Cain was hiding from the own inconsistencies in his life. He knew where Abel's corpse was. He knew God knew where Abel's corpse was. And maybe even suspected that God was behind some tree watching his cruel act. Yet he continued to pile one incongruity on another. The man putting the wheat and the corn on the fiery altar was a bundle of paradoxes. He lived a life of self-contradiction. He was hypocritical. He was a sheep in lion's clothing and at the same time a lion in sheep's clothing. Well, rebellion reaches out from that bloody field of wheat somewhere east of the Garden of Eden right into this auditorium. It's here, and we know it. And we fight it, and we're often defeated by it. And there's a fierce animal that lurks at the door of our hearts at this very moment. And it makes us bitter and unruly and uncooperative and angry and depressed and lustful and out of control. Rebellion? We've been there. Revolt? That's me sometimes. Insubordination? I know what that's like. Self-contradiction? It's right here. Paradoxical living? Inconsistency? That describes me. If Cain had been in the Garden of Eden instead of Eve, the story might have turned out quite differently. As soon as Cain heard the words, "Do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil," he'd rush right over to that tree, taking out a big bite. And when God came looking for Cain in the underbrush of the garden, Cain would have lied and said, "Not me, God. I didn't eat of your precious tree." Now you may find yourself more like compliant Eve, circling the tree in the garden with the serpent in her ear. But I suspect we're more like the defiant Cain, there at the altar, fighting God nearly every step of the way. Like Cain, we may find God appearing as we walk away from the scene of the crime. We may find God intruding into our lives more than we really want. And it's that thought that directs us to the real hero of this episode. The hero of this story is not Abel, who offers the right sacrifice. The heroes of the story are not Adam and Eve, who managed to stay out of the church problems that the boys were having. The hero of the story is not the animal lurking outside the door to Cain's heart, waiting to get a foothold inside and wreak havoc. The hero is God. It's the God who intercepts Cain on the way back from the field, inquires about Abel's health. It's God who finds himself confronted with a murderer, and in spite of all of our expectations, lets the murderer live. It's the God who has special ears to hear the cry of Abel's blood as it soaked up into the ground. So God tells the farmer, Cain, "You're not going to farm anymore. You thought thorns and thistles were bad. Wait till you see what I've got in store for you. You're going to wander from place to place. You're going to have to eat berries, harvest crops that others have sown. You're going to have to live in a tent. Stay on the move. Never know a place called home." And we find that simply amazing. Amazing that God saw something in Cain worth salvaging. We expect God to send a flood over to Cain's farm. We expect God to make Cain face the music. We expect Cain to be indicted on charges of murder. Instead of putting him in prison, God makes him into the first gypsy. Now that's incredible. It's almost unbelievable. Yet God's kind response to rebellious Cain is just the first in an as yet incomplete series of salvage operations that this God has carried out. God allows Cain to make his own decisions, and when he makes bad ones, God keeps coming back. God doesn't turn his back on Cain after his inappropriate sacrifice. God doesn't turn his back on Cain's anger and depression. God doesn't turn his back on Cain's fratricide. God doesn't turn his back on Cain's outright lie. But rather, as he sinks deeper and deeper, God's arm becomes longer and stronger to lift him out. But rebellion is not easy to cure. Not only does Cain bring the wrong sacrifice, not only does he get angry, not only does he kill his brother, not only does he lie to God, not only does he deny responsibility, he complains about his punishment. There's no doubt that Cain was what James Dobson would call a strong-willed child. He cries out to God, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." He's afraid that since he's murdered, others will seek revenge. The murderer worries about being murdered. And God responds in love. God puts a mark on Cain, not to brand him as a wicked man, but to protect him from his own kind. He gives Cain a sign that this man is under my protection. And don't you mess with him unless you want to incur divine wrath 7 times more powerful than anything you've ever seen before. And so Cain is given an insurance policy by God with all the premiums paid up. Cain, a bad man, to be sure, but not a man beyond God's love. Cain, full of rebellion and insubordination, independence and defiance, but not out of the reach of this God. Cain, stubborn and rude and inconsiderate, but not able to stump this God. And so this passage offers hope to the Cain within each one of us by showing us a glimpse of the kind of unstumpable God that we serve. There's a scene in John Steinbeck's East of Eden, which is another modern attempt to recreate the Cain and Abel story, in which Adam, the father of the two boys, Caleb and Aaron, who represent Cain and Abel, talks about this episode in Genesis 4. Adam has an old Chinese servant named Lee, and they go back and forth about the Cain and Abel story. And after lengthy discussion in the novel, they conclude that the text is trying to tell us that women and men can always choose to conquer evil. Well, I think that's part of the meaning of the episode, but I think Steinbeck has missed the broader point. And that is that Genesis 4, 1 through 16, is telling us that no matter how civilized we think we are, no matter how much we cover up our own motives and our own thoughts from other people, there's a rebelliousness inside. And that when it comes out, we have a God who never gives up. The best news is you can overcome that Cain-like rebelliousness in your life by coming to know the same God who dealt with ancient Cain. And here in our own little land of Nod, out here east of Eden, God loves us and He blesses us and He offers to make something out of us in spite of who we are and what we do. And throughout history, God has always called His people, in this time as well as in our present time, to be people of faith, to trust Him, to believe that His Son is Lord. And in New Testament times, the plan is expressed in a very unique way. We're to bring our lives alongside the life of Jesus, to give up the things that separate us from Him, and to be willing from the time we accept Him as Lord to publicly say that He is Lord, He is God, He is my Savior, finally allowing all that to culminate in an act of baptism where we trust God and He forgives us. If you have that Cain-like rebelliousness and it's at the verge of taking over, make it go another way. Submit to God as we stand and as we sing.